top story, Saudi warplanes conduct fresh airstrikes on Yemen, targeting a food depot in the capital, Sana'a. Thousands of people take to the streets of Barcelona to protest against COVID-19 passes required to enter public places. A volcano erupts on Indonesia's Java Island, killing 13, injuring dozens, and forcing thousands to flee. Welcome to the program. Another deadly airstrike by the Saudi-led coalition leaves casualties in Yemen's capital city of Sana'a. Reports of fatalities and severe injuries are coming in. The air raid has also damaged residential areas in a targeted neighborhood in Sana'a. Local media say similar airstrikes have been carried out on other Yemeni cities, including Sa'ada, Hajjah, and Taiz, which was bombed on Friday as well. 18 people also died during that assault. These fatalities add up to hundreds of thousands of Yemenis who have been killed during the 6 years of Saudi onslaught against their country. Political commentator Scott Bennett says Saudi Arabia's aggressive measures in Yemen are U.S.-backed acts of belligerence, and well, that should be immediately condemned by the international community.
Well, there's no sense when it comes to you know, this being any sort of a movement towards peace or reconciliation or the cessation of hostilities. This is only a U.S. Sponsored and supported act of belligerence, and in fact a crime against humanity for which the World Court and the United Nations and all respective international bodies should condemn. Condemned for the poisoning and the death of children and the biochemical terror warfare that the Saudis have exercised on Yemen and the killing of children. This is precisely what the Western democracies are supposed to stand up against, but of course they're not, because it is a tool, it is a pawn, it is a information warfare tactic that the West is going to try and amplify and expand to create more hostility. So I think there's a variety of reasons why this is happening, of course. One is the ineptitude and incompetence of the West. The other possibility is Washington is fully sanctioning and, in fact, encouraging this strike to try and create a proxy war, try and create more conflicts for Iran and try and draw Iran into a conflict a form of using this to exhaust them militarily. I don't think Iran will fall into that.
French president is in Saudi Arabia as part of a visit to a number of Persian Gulf Arab countries. Macron is the first Western leader to visit Riyadh since Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. We have a report.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accuse the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Iran's air defense force says it's carried out a test in the central province of Isfahan. The drill was carried out nearly 20 kilometers away from the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran's army spokesman says the test was conducted in full coordination with the country's integrated air defense network. Take a listen.
About an hour ago, one of the missile systems in the region was tested to ensure its field readiness. The test was carried out to assess the performance of the system installed in the region. Such drills take place in a safe environment with full coordination with the integrated defense network. There's no reason for concern.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has called for expansion of ties between Tehran and Caracas. In a phone conversation with President Maduro, Raisi said the two countries should increase their economic relations and trade volume. He also called for greater oil cooperation between the two countries. The president believes the two nations need to take greater steps in refining and petrochemical fields. He also slammed Washington's sanctions on Caracas. Maduro hailed Iran's support for the Venezuelan people and hoped that Tehran and Caracas would sign new cooperation agreements. Ebrahim Raisi became the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran early in August. During his time in office, Raisi has sought to strengthen ties with neighbors and other countries, particularly those on the eastern side of the globe. Domestically, he has focused on strengthening the country's vaccination campaign against the coronavirus pandemic. Here's a report.
August the 5th, 2021. Ebrahim Raisi becomes Iran's eighth president after a landslide victory in elections. He had little time to celebrate his win. Iran was facing a plethora of challenges, from both within and without. Raisi had to steer the country under severe US sanctions and hit by a raging global pandemic. The first order of business was making sure of people's health. When Raisi took the helm, Iran was recording over 30,000 daily COVID cases. Several hundred people were also losing their lives to the virus each day. In less than 5 months, the numbers began to fall significantly. Iran got to have just over 2,000 new coronavirus cases every day. The number of fatalities reported daily has fallen below 60, and 3 out of 5 Iranians have been fully vaccinated. Also high on Raisi's foreign policy agenda has been expanding ties with neighboring countries. To that end, in late August, Iran attended a summit in the Iraqi capital. There, Iran's foreign minister met with its counterpart from Persian Gulf states in a bid to strengthen bilateral ties. Raisi's foreign policy brought Iran a major milestone in September, when the country became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a multinational body which includes the likes of China, Russia, and India, and enjoys wide-scale global influence. President Raisi has also tried to shore up the country's economy by relieving the pressure of sanctions. His government has taken part in the Vienna negotiations in a bid to have US-imposed sanctions on Iran removed. The next round of talks is set to kick off next week. The challenges Iran is facing are by no means over. But judging President Raisi's first 4 months in office, better days seem to be in the offing for the country.
Protesters rally across Europe against restrictions aimed at combating the resurgence of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Austria, tens of thousands of protesters marched through the capital, Vienna, amid tightened security. Last month, the country became the first in Western Europe to reimpose a national lockdown to curb a surge in daily infections. It also plans to make vaccinations compulsory from February. In Spain, thousands of protesters gathered in Barcelona against COVID vaccine passes that are now required to enter restaurants, gyms, and care homes, a smaller march was held in the central Dutch city of Utrecht amid a heavy presence of security forces. Violent protests broke out 3 weeks ago, shortly after the Dutch government announced the lockdown. Tighter restrictions have since come into force. France's yellow vests have become a worldwide phenomenon, but they have repeatedly accused their own domestic media of refusing to cover their marches. Now, during their latest nationwide demonstration, a yellow vest group has targeted government media headquarters to accuse them of not fulfilling their duty to taxpayers. Ramin Mazoheri is in Paris.
If the yellow vests march, but the mainstream media doesn't cover it, does it have an effect? In the age of social media, the answer seems to be an unequivocal yes, perhaps much to the anger of so-called legacy media. Since the Yellow Vests started their season 2, domestic media has been almost completely absent. But for the 8th consecutive Saturday, they marched nationwide, shut down toll booths, and occupied roundabouts. The Yellow Vests say they don't expect fair treatment from France's private media. Less than 10 billionaires control 90% of all the nation's media, with strict control over an editorial policy which many say is often right-wing.
Starting in June 2019, France's mainstream media simply stopped reporting on the Yellow Vests. However, they continued to march nationwide in major numbers through the two-month general strike that winter and until March 2020, when the coronavirus forced a ban on all public demonstrations.
In Paris, one of the Yellow Vest demonstrations gathered outside of government-owned Radio France's headquarters to denounce the failure of public media journalists to provide fair coverage of the nation's biggest social movement in decades.
We pay our taxes to support public media and we pay to help privately owned media as well, but they both relay the exact same opinions and both exclude and they both slander any dissenting voices. What we're asking for is that the diversity of opinions be respected and we're telling these journalists to stop their censorship and propaganda.
The ever-increasing concentration of French media ownership has forced the government to act. This week, they quietly authorized a commission to investigate the issue, with results due in early 2022. The conclusions will likely have a lot to say about the true freedom of the French press during the age of Western corporate domination. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
Anger boiling in Serbia over the government's new mining plans. Thousands of environmentalists blocked major roads and bridges across the country for a second Saturday in a row in protest at the projects. Thousands gathered on the main bridge in the capital, Belgrade, and stopped traffic on the main highway. That despite police warnings and an intimidation campaign by authorities, a number of other cities were scenes of similar protests. Environmentalists are angry at the government's plan to give mining rights to two foreign companies. They're also against two newly passed laws, which they say will lay the groundwork for a lithium mining operation. They're worried the laws will let foreign companies exploit local resources. Green activists say the projects will pollute land and water in the Balkan nation. Experts warn that energy poverty could impact up to 80 million people in the European Union before the end of winter. This is while the bloc's leaders are struggling to agree on a coordinated approach to address rising gas and electricity prices. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
The European Commission's Joint Research Centre says 50 million people in the EU are suffering the effects of so-called energy poverty. It means households are having to prioritise food over heat. EU energy ministers have been meeting in Brussels to assess the crisis.
Since we launched our communication and toolbox on energy prices, 20 member states have taken or announced measures to mitigate the impact on their people and businesses, in particular the most vulnerable.
But that means almost a third of EU governments have not taken any action to protect citizens. Gas and electricity prices are out of control. Civil society organizations are forecasting that energy poverty will be hitting 80 million people in the EU before winter is over. The EU's dysfunctional energy market is currently in a state of flux. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's gas. The European Commission confirms Moscow is fulfilling all of its supply contracts. However, energy storage is a problem in the EU. Supplies were depleted last winter due to unusually cold weather. Then there was huge demand when EU nations began lifting COVID-19 restrictions. Energy experts say the EU could benefit if it improved relations with Russia. The 27-country bloc could also push back against US foreign policy so that new supply chains could be utilised, for example, with respect to Iran, which has enormous energy reserves. EU leaders are divided over how to deal with the crisis, but it's clear there are no quick fixes. The matter will be high on their agenda when they meet here in just under 2 weeks' time for a summit on the 16th of December. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
13 people have died and dozens have suffered burns following a volcanic eruption on the Indonesian island of Java. Mount Semeru has been sending a large plume of smoke and ash into the sky since Saturday afternoon. The smoke plume has reportedly reached a height of over 12 kilometers, forcing thousands of nearby residents to flee. Airlines have been warned that the ash could rise up to 15 kilometers. Officials say a number of areas went dark after being covered by volcanic ash. The lava flow has also destroyed a road and a bridge. Evacuations are underway as we speak. The Southeast Asian country is home to nearly 130 active volcanoes. In late 2018, an eruption in the straits between Java and Sumatra Islands caused a tsunami which killed more than 400 people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Trump-era pilot program that could result in the complete privatization of traditional Medicare in a matter of years is moving ahead under the Biden administration. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden is quietly continuing a Trump-era ploy to privatize Medicare. Stay tuned for more. Trump-era pilot program that could result in the complete privatization of traditional Medicare in a matter of years is moving ahead under the Biden administration, a development that, despite its potentially massive implications for patients across the U.S., has received scant attention from the national press or Congress. Recently, a group of physicians from around the U.S. tried to grab the notice of lawmakers, the Biden White House, and the public by traveling to Washington, D.C. and demanding that the Health and Human Services Department, that is HHS, immediately stop the Medicare experiment, which is known as direct contracting, that is DC. The doctors plan to present HHS with a petition signed by more than 1,500 physicians who believe the DC pilot threatens the future of Medicare as they know it. Advocates have been publicly sounding the alarm about the DC program for months, warning that it could fully hand traditional Medicare over to Wall Street investors and other profit seekers, resulting in higher costs
for patients and lower quality care. Diane Archer, the founder of Just Care USA and the senior advisor on Medicare at Social Security Works, told Common Dreams in an email, "Everything we know about direct contracting should be cost to hold the pilot. Direct contracting effectively eliminates the more cost-effective traditional Medicare program designed to ensure that people with complex health conditions get the care they need." Archer argued the direct contracting experiment is likely to be both a healthcare policy and a political nightmare. We already know from the Medicare Advantage experiment that direct contracting won't save money, nor will it be able to show improved quality. But healthcare campaigners' concerns have fallen largely on deaf ears in the U.S. Congress and the Biden administration, which has allowed much of the pilot program to proceed as planned. In a phone interview with Common Dreams, the head of the recent demonstration at HHS headquarters, Dr. Ed Weisbart, chair of the Missouri Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, said that Congress is largely asleep at the switch as Wall Street-backed startups and private insurance giants close in on traditional Medicare, a 56-year-old program that covers tens of millions of U.S. seniors. Weisbart, one of the physicians traveling to the nation's capital, said of the D.C. experiment, "People don't know that's happening. Most people in Congress don't know that it's happening. We have started having some of these conversations with the congressional staff, and we are hoping to have many more of them next week when we are there, but it's not on their radar either," he added. "That's the disturbing part. How radical the transformation of Medicare is becoming under this new model. How widespread it will be. It will be the entire book of business, and yet that's occurring with neither the awareness nor consent of Congress." The DC program was established by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI, during the waning month of the Trump administration, which included former pharmaceutical industry executives, Wall Street bankers, and right-wing policy consultants notorious for gashing public health programs. Under the DC model, so-called direct contracting entities, that is, DCEs, are paid monthly by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, to cover a specified portion of a patient's medical care, a significant shift from traditional Medicare's direct reimbursement of providers. DCEs are allowed to pocket the funding they don't spend on care, an arrangement that critics believe will incentivize the private middlemen to skimp on Medicare patients, many of whom could be auto-enrolled into DCEs without their knowledge or permission. According to a policy brief released by PNHP, virtually any company can apply to be a DCE, including investor-backed startups that include primary care physicians, Medicare Advantage plans, and other commercial insurers, accountable care organizations, including ACOs and ACO-like organizations, and for-profit hospital systems. Applicants are approved by CMS without input from Congress or other elected officials, the group notes. At present, the pilot includes 53 DCEs in 38 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. DRS Richard Griffin and Donald Berwick pointed out in a September article for Health Affairs that 28 of the current DCEs are controlled by investors, not healthcare providers. A second tranche of DCEs is expected to debut in January 2022. Dr. Anna Melino, a physician from San Francisco who is taking part In the petitions, Delivery said in a statement that Medicare Advantage, the first wave of Medicare privatization, showed us that inserting a profit-seeking middleman into public coverage does not save money for taxpayers, but rather cost more money while also taking away care choices from seniors. Molino said, if left unchecked, the direct contracting program will hand traditional Medicare off to Wall Street investors without input from seniors, doctors, or even members of Congress. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Breca has the power to stop this Trump-era program in its tracks and must do so now. The DC experiment was launched by the Trump administration, but actually has its roots in the Affordable Care Act, ACA, which established CMMI with the stated goal of identifying ways to improve healthcare quality and reduce costs in a Medicare, Medicaid, and Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP programs. The ACA granted CMMI, also known as the Innovation Center, the authority to test alternative payment and service delivery models on national scale without congressional approval, latitude that, in the hands of the Trump administration, ultimately spawned the DC pilot program. CMMI is currently headed by Elizabeth Fowler, who previously served as Vice President of Public Policy and External Affairs for WellPoint Incorporations, a health insurance giant that later became Anthem. Fowler also worked as chief health counsel to former Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus, a right-wing Democrat who infamously had single-payer proponents arrested in 2009 and helped ensure that the ACA did not include a public option. Weisbar told Common Dreams that while the creation of CMMI may have been well-intentioned, the body's ability to so fundamentally and radically transform a public health program that so many Americans rely on without congressional approval or oversight is a real danger that lawmakers must take seriously. Someplace there needs to be congressional oversight, Weisbar said. When the public does finally find out that lawmakers were asleep at the switch, they're not going to be happy. This is your chance to do what democracy is intended to do. In a column earlier this month, the Houston Chronicle's Chris Tomlinson argued that the Biden administration's decision to allow the DC program to continue reflects for-profit health companies and investors' power over both political parties.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and let us ponder on the words of the Prophet of Islam regarding his divinely decreed vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Nobody properly knows Allah except me and Ali. Nobody properly knows me except Allah and Ali. Nobody properly knows Ali except Allah and me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, chastity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of chastity in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, we know that in the Islamic lifestyle, chastity is one of the most important parts of this lifestyle. And we all must have this chastity, this haya or ifaf, which is used in the Islamic texts, in the Arabic texts. This is very important. That a person who is believer, he must have the chastity in his life. And there are many prayers in which we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the same thing. We ask, for example, we say, Allahumma zayyini fihi bis-sitri wal-afaf, that, oh Allah, please give me the chastity and decorate my life with the chastity, with the chastity. And this is very, very important, that a person who believes that he is the believer and he is the true believer, he must have this chastity in his life. Now, this chastity is not only for the women, it's also for the men. There is a chastity for men and women both. So we cannot say that the only thing, only chastity is for women. No, it's for the men as well. And this is very important that we follow this thing, and we have this chastity in our life. Therefore, in order to have chastity, there are a couple of things which we need to know. The first thing in chastity is modesty. If a person has the modesty, he will definitely have the chastity as well. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of chastity, And we said that modesty is one of the basic parts of this chastity, that a person must have this modesty in his life, haya in his life, and this chastity should be, you know, it should be in the clothing, in the, we can say, like when he's talking to someone, when he is looking at someone, when he is communicating to someone. You know, this is very important, that when you're in a society, how you should live this modesty. It is not only for the men, it's also for the women as well. And on the other side, like, it's not only for the women, it's for the men as well. Therefore, you know, in the society, in the Islamic society, a lady must cover herself. A lady must cover herself when she is in the public. And when she goes out, she must cover. She should not wear such a clothes which will make people attracting towards her. For example, way of, you know, stepping on the floor, or the shoe selection of the shoes, selection of the clothes. Similarly, a man should also have this modesty, that when he's talking to someone who is non-mahram, who is when he's talking to someone, he must also have this modesty in his eyes, in his way of talking, in his thinking and thoughts. And we need to be very much careful when we are outside there, because this first important thing within chastity, which is modesty, it should be seen in everyone, so that when they socialize among the people, and when they're socializing, they do make sure that they're living with the modesty, and they have this chastity, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Swedish city of Stockholm has launched its 31st annual Christmas competition of baking gingerbread.
There is a limited in space, so it's 40 centimeters by 40 centimeters, and everything you build, all the material, need to be eatable. So you can build with different things, gingerbread of course, but also candies and other things, but you need to be able to eat it. So that's one of the rules as well.
Each year, the Gingerbread House competition, hosted by ArcDes Museum of Architecture and Design, has a theme for the designs. This year's theme is Together, attracting various interpretations of the topic. So far, the entries have included the Titanic, the famous coffee shop from the American TV show Friends, an igloo, and the Berlin Wall, all entirely edible. The event, which has been running for 31 years, is designed for all kinds of creators, such as children, young people, adults, amateurs, and professionals. The Tasty Exhibition runs until January the 5th. A Palestinian teacher has developed an assistant for himself nicknamed Mr. Robot, bringing joy to the children of a school in Gaza. Mr. Robot teaches the children of Al-Basma School about electric circuits and helps them memorize their lessons. Mr. Robot moves freely in the classroom, speaking Arabic to students and communicating with them as a friend. The teacher creating it says the aim was to stimulate creativity and innovation in his classroom.
Mr. Robot, as his name suggests, is the teacher's assistant and not his replacement. He assists in the education process by asking questions and giving answers, greeting students and interacting with them in all aspects of a class.
The teacher says at first students reacted to it in a strange way, but later on they said it was like a dream come true for them. Local engineers say the robot is the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, where electrical tools and components are scarce.
Artificial intelligence has found its way into several aspects of our lives. Now, a French research team is working on a project to provide fishermen with intelligent trawls that could help them sort out fishes before they are brought to the boats.
The objective of the project is to try to provide a support tool for fishermen, because at the moment, when they put their fishing gear in the water, a trawl net is like a large net. It is towed behind the vessel for several hours without having knowledge of what enters the trawl net in real time. Namely, is it species that are targeted by the fishermen or not targeted?
The trawl head has a camera that can capture footage underwater, which is then analyzed by a microcomputer using artificial intelligence. If targeted fishes are detected, the trawl will switch to fishing mode. But when there are no targeted species, it will switch back to flight mode to avoid having an impact on the seabed. Another feature of this technology is to identify and classify pelagic species. For instance, horse mackerel can be displayed in blue on the screen, while the sardines are shown in pink. If you enjoy nighttime adventures, then this park in Paris is just for you. Decorated with colorful lighting, the venue gives you a real feeling of life-size sculptures depicting dinosaurs and other prehistoric animals. In this exhibition, dubbed Evolution on the Path of Lights, visitors can walk through tunnels formed by some of the sculptors. They are made of paper, steel, and lights. More than 100 sculptors light up like lanterns across the park. These include well-known favorites of kids, such as Triceratops and T-Rex. Some huge lanterns also represent insects and vertebrates that walked on the planet millions of years ago. The exhibition's director says the goal is to raise awareness and educate the public about biodiversity in the past and present.
In Thailand, monkeys climbing on piles of fruits and vegetables in central Thailand. It is not due to a mess, though. It is actually an annual event called the Monkey Festival in Lopburi Province. The long-tailed monkeys, known as macaques, feast on 2 tons of fruits and vegetables in Lopburi. That is the capital city of the province with the same name. Locals say the event is a symbolic way to thank the cute animals for doing their part in drawing tourists to their town. This year's festival took place after a 2-year halt due to the pandemic.
Today is the 33rd time that we held this event. This year under the theme of Wheelchair Monkey Party, where we organizers will donate 100 wheelchairs to people in need. I would say the event is very successful. Many Thais and tourists are visiting.
Lopburi has been holding the annual festival for its monkey population for decades now. COVID restrictions meant last year's party was missing its usual crowd of spectators. However, this year the humans were back in force with more than 100 turning out to see the monkeys. Historical monuments have many duplicates made by enthusiasts around the world. India's Taj Mahal is not an exception. But the one you're about to see right now is not just the physical copy. It shares the spirit of Taj Mahal as well. This mini replica is located in the city of Burhanpur, some 800 kilometers away from the magnificent Taj Mahal itself. It has a love story behind it too, just as Taj Mahal does. Anand Parkash Choksi, a teacher, has built this replica as a gift to his spouse. It took Chuxi 3 years to build the four-bedroom house that is decorated by artisans from Agra, where Taj Mahal is located. He says that he has made the replica to show his love and spread the message of peace. Taj Mahal was built by a Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan in memory of his wife Mumtaz Mahal back in the 17th century. Now, for those interested in ancient history, Egypt has unveiled a renovated ancient road dating back some 3,400 years in a spectacular nighttime ceremony. This historical corridor is nearly 3 kilometers long and connects the temples of Karnak and Luxor in the center of the southern city of Nile. The stone road, also known as the Avenue of Sphinxes or the Ramza Road, features over 1,000 traditional sphinxes and ram-headed statues on its sides. The site was buried under layers of sand until it was discovered back in the late 1940s. Since then, the path has undergone decades of excavation efforts, but experts say that many statues have been completely damaged.
Sphinx statues were completely damaged and in very bad condition because wrong restoration works were conducted in the 1960s and 1970s. In the previous century, they used wrong materials for the restorations. Now we're using internationally recognized materials for the restoration works.
Egypt has described the site as the largest open museum in the world. The new attraction aims to help revive the country's tourism industry. The sector has been hit hard due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Robots now helping as teaching aids in some Korean kindergartens. The pint-sized machines do everything they can, from singing to reciting stories. The robots, being as tall as nearly 25 centimeters, can also dance, have sing songs, and even teach kung fu moves. That gives children fun as they mimic the robots' push-ups and one-legged balances. It's also good for the kids' creativity. In fact, that's the purpose of sending the robots to hundreds of kindergartens in Seoul, beginning from August. Each robot has a camera and its helmet, making it possible to take photos and send them to a tablet for viewing. Teachers say they love their new ways.
The robots are helpful when at times it's hard for me to read everyone's stories. The robots can read out stories in a very entertaining way by switching voices accordingly.
For now, the robots are being used as part of a pilot program, but Korean education officials hope to use them more widely, although they say the machines would not replace teachers. The officials believe having this experience in nursery schools will have a lasting effect throughout the kids' youth and as adults.
Spacecraft are used for a range of purposes, from observation to exploration and navigation. But this specific spacecraft was designed for a totally different purpose, to smash into an asteroid. In a first-of-its-kind mission, NASA launched the vehicle, Dot, from a Space Force base in California. The mission will take 10 months to travel to a pair of asteroids. It will eventually crash into one of two rocks and see if it can change its course. Just before impact, DART will deploy a small satellite to take photos of the crash. Space organizations around the world are eager to find ways of countering objects that might head towards the Earth. The good news, though, is that for now, none of those objects are a threat. We'll be right back. old manuscripts are precious and can sometimes fetch attractive sums of money. But this one has gone far beyond, as it's a really rare handwriting belonging to a world-famous scientist. This manuscript was sold for a whopping $13 million at an auction at Christie's in Paris. But would you still be surprised if we told you that it belongs to no one but the great physicist of our time, Albert Einstein? Einstein did not have a habit of keeping drafts, and this is one of only two manuscripts that have survived. Einstein wrote the 54-page document in the early 1900s in Zurich, Switzerland, and his colleague Michel Besseau has preserved it since then. The document contains Einstein's preparatory work for his signature achievement, the theory of general relativity. Einstein's letters have set records twice before, but for much lower prices. November is the best time of the year to see polar bears moving around Canadian shores. During this month, the carnivores gather in large numbers and wait for the waters to freeze before they begin their seal hunt. These bears are playing and wrestling in the Canadian city of Churchill, dubbed the polar bear capital of the world. The area is located within a natural habitat of a large population of polar bears. Sometimes the city's residents even share their streets with these animals. Currently, there are nearly 25,000 polar bears in the world, and Canada is home to more than 17,000 of them. However, wildlife organizations say these animals are facing the threat of extinction by the end of the century due to global warming. Robots in a war-ravaged city. Androids serve clients in a restaurant in Mosul, an Iraqi city that still bears the scars of the years-long presence of terrorist groups. This fully digital eatery offers a futuristic experience to its customers. From interactive tables to glowing constellations, everything seems like a journey to the future. But the robot waiters are the stars of the show, and the major reason the restaurant attracts a large number of visitors every night.
The idea started during the COVID lockdown. As you know, people spent most of their time on social media during that period, since commuting was not allowed. So we tried to look at different ideas from around the world, and thank God we were able to execute this idea and complete this project.
The owner of the eatery says he has imported the robots, but other technologies used there are the work of a group of young engineers from the University of Mosul. The venue has already become very popular, and many visitors call it their favorite place in the city. Qatar displays a dazzling drone show as it unveils the countdown clock for the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Doha. The clock, in the shape of an hourglass, is located at Doha's iconic Cornish fishing spot. The distinctive design enables the structure to be seen from any angle and stand out from the spectacular city skyline behind it. The event reveals to fans worldwide that just 1 year to go to the big kickoff. Famous athletes including David Beckham and Samuel Eto'o were in attendance at the ceremony.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Criminalizing Hamas may please the Israeli regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people, says Avi Shalem, writer in an article titled "Hamas Terror Listing is Yet Another UK Betrayal of the Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. British Home Secretary Priti Patel has declared her intention to proscribe the whole of Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement that rules the Gaza Strip, as a terrorist organization. The military wing of the group was proscribed in the UK back in March 2001. 20 years on, the Home Secretary proposes to extend this ban to the political wing by arguing that the distinction between the two wings is no longer tenable. The truth of the matter is that the distinction was tenable in 2001 and it is still tenable today. What is more, it is a crucial distinction. Patel's announcement came soon after Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime war minister, designated six Palestinian civil society NGO groups as terrorist organizations. This designation came close on the heels of the decision by the International Criminal Court, ICC, to launch a full-scale investigation of alleged war crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Zionist regime war minister, Benny Gantz, was Israel's forces chief of staff during its assault on Gaza in July 2014, in which at least 2,256 Palestinians were martyred, of whom 1,462 were civilians, including 551 children. This makes Gantz a prime suspect in the ICC's war crimes probe. Hamas agreed to cooperate with the ICC investigation, but the Zionist regime refused. Some of the Palestinian organizations placed on the Zionist regime's terrorist list are cooperating with the ICC investigation. Although the evidence produced by the Israeli regime was judged inadequate by the European Union and the US government, the terrorism labor achieved its goal of stigmatizing the NGOs, curbing their ability to raise funds, and disrupting their operations. The Zionist regime's move was widely condemned as an attack on human rights. The British Home Secretary was not among the protesters. Patel shares with UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson a Manichean view of the West Asia region struggle, in which the Zionist regime represents the forces of light and Palestinian Hamas the forces of darkness. The reality is slightly more complicated.